Hello, and welcome to The Learning College. My name is Alex Linder, and you can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com, permanently archived. And as I record stuff, I put the links out at different places, including our own pyvil.net social media. Now, today is the ultimate recording, that means final recording, of George Lincoln Rockwell's White Power. We're going to do the last two chapters, which are fairly brief together, and one of them's really brief, the last 15 and 16, pages 256 to 272 on the PDF, which I believe you can find online. Just search for it. And of course, I usually put the link to the PDF in the permanent file of VNN Forum. So let's dig in. Now, George Lincoln Rockwell, I believe the last book he wrote, White Power, before he was assassinated. And we know what he saw was happening from our early recordings. And now in the last one, we're going to hear what he thinks we should do about it. George Lincoln Rockwell, White Power, Chapter 15, National Socialism. National Socialism. So far, says Rockwell, this book has been mostly critical. Now it is time to present constructive plans for building and creating. I put a year of research and hundreds of pages of writing into the effort to help the reader see and understand that Western civilization is within a very, very few years of the end reached by Roman civilization. Oblivion. Western civ is going the way of Roman civ in a few more years, he wrote in the 60s. It's going into oblivion. And that he, the you, the reader, me, the speaker, will personally suffer the fate of millions who have already fallen into the hands of the Jewish mortal enemies of Western civilization. Enslavement. Or, more likely, murder. Unless we can find the will and the wisdom somehow to stop running away from the enemy and attack him with a white revolution. Just how do you go about creating a revolution? Are we all to grow beards, rush into the streets, and begin shouting, waving our arms, throwing bombs, and otherwise acting the part of the stereotype revolutionaries? Remember, he's writing the time of the hippies and the anti-Vietnam protests. Are we supposed to act like them? No, of course not. Our revolution has all been laid out for us. Hitler inspired, organized, and pulled off a relatively peaceful revolution, a revolution which took far fewer lives than the American Revolution, and an insignificant number of lives compared to any ever pulled off by the Jewish Bolsheviks. Interesting way to think about it. When Hitler took power in 1933, there were a lot less lives lost than in the American Revolution, let alone the Soviet Revolution that he was a response to. Not only that, but Hitler's revolution, as he promised in Mein Kampf, was 100% legal, quote-unquote. Legitimate, the formally expressed will of the majority of the German people, sanctioned by both the top executive officer of Germany, von Hindenburg, and by the German Congress, the Reichstag. Hitler had many opportunities to seize power by force, and he could have done it easily in 1931. But Hitler believed that a revolution against the will of the people, a revolution that gains power only by force, cannot long endure. Well, he believed that after the putsch, initially, which was an attempt to seize power, and then his jailing, and then he was for a legitimate revolution. He wound up getting about 30% plus of the vote, but he did achieve office by legitimate democratic means, if you want to put those two together. Hitler, as I do, believed that a leader is an enemy of civilization unless he has the will of his people behind him. How then can I be calling for a revolution? How can I write of killing and being killed? Is not the very essence of revolution violence? Not necessarily. There may be an element of violence, yes. When you are attacked by a killer and faced with a choice of death or dealing death yourself, then violence is the only possibility. And Western civilization is indeed under attack by an enemy who regularly, as a matter of policy, kills and massacres more ruthlessly than any group in history, as our rightist Jews are murdering, literally murdering babies and bombing hospitals in Gaza. So we must be violent enough to put a stop to the communist enemy's killing and ruthless enough to smash his power. There had been a footnote above, which I'll read. One, in 1923, when the Reds threatened to seize power in Bavaria, remember they took, after World War I, they fomented little mini Soviet revolutions, mini communist revolutions, attempting to duplicate what was going on in Russia, and they actually seized power in Bavaria and a couple other places in Germany before the loyalist nationalist soldiers returning home from World War I counter overthrew them. In 1923, when the Reds threatened to seize power in Bavaria, the nationalists, the conservatives, and General Ludendorff asked Hitler to lead a putsch, a revolt in Munich. See, he's as an honest man would, he is noting, he is realizing that someone is going to say what I said without knowing the footnote, that while we know for a fact he did try to overthrow the government, now he's explaining himself and why he says what he said. Then the weakling leaders double-crossed him at the last moment. The putsch was crushed and Hitler was sent to prison. But this was not a revolution against the will of the people, as events proved later. But the essence of a real revolution is never just the bloodshed and upheaval. In a genuine and lasting revolution, violence and killing are only one expedient means to the end of a radical change in overall spiritual outlook, the outward manifestation of a supreme human will to establish a new arrangement of physical affairs to conform with an inner ideal. The authority exercised by most of those in power today is unadulterated tyranny, back to the main text, though it is hypocritically disguised as democracy. It is not the benevolent, intelligent authority to maintain order and justice established by the founding fathers for the benefit of white men. Our revolution must be based firmly on the ideal of destroying the illegal power of tyrants and restoring a just social order that is based on a firm authority that comes straight from our people and is freely granted to a leader. That, believe it or not, is precisely what Adolf Hitler did for Germany and what we must do for America. Provide the nation with a white head, genuine, authentic, elite leadership representing what the mass of people know that they need and want. Not in for graft, not in for corruption, not in to say one thing and do another, but to actually lead, actually do what you say, actually look out for the interest of the average white people who made America great when it was great. This is what he's saying. Our revolution, in short, must have as its driving force and goal not merely the hatred and destruction of the enemy, but it must be imbued with an absolute determination to establish a just social order in which each man can achieve his maximum potential as a successful, happy, and productive part of our great white race. In my words, I'd say give the white man the context in which he can flourish. And while normally individualism and collectivism are opposed, when you locate the individual inside of a white context, the white individual can flourish as he can in no other system. And the only ones who can't flourish are the ones who are flourishing today, the race mixers, the sellouts, the traitors, the scumbags. What is such a just order of society? There is no need for this understanding of the scientific principles of successful group living among those in healthy societies where natural instincts are unimpaired. Animals, for instance, have orderly, successful societies because nature gives every social creature all the instincts he needs for successful group living. You know, only racially mixed societies need Jew social scientists to tell them how they're doing it wrong and need to reorder themselves. In nature, things arrange themselves as they are, and whites are decentralized and able ad hoc to set up whatever they need. We're more individualistic than other races, but we must work together where that's in our interest. Wolves, ants, bees, and apes, for instance, have highly organized and thoroughly healthy, orderly societies. Pack, troop, colony. Early man had healthy societies Then man's growing control over nature allowed him to escape his natural environment and surround himself with artificialities and luxury until he became decadent and full of arrogant conceit, a conceit that is today called, quote, liberalism. Only by going back to the simpler and more primitive life situation of the unthinking and uncivilized animal world and observing the workings of the instincts given them by the Creator can we catch a glimpse of the wonders of what has been given us and which we have thrown away. Nature has created breeds, in quotes, with which she can experiment and seek always better breeds, just as does a good farmer. The Creator, being an infinitely wiser farmer than any human, absolutely insists on the purity, the sanctity, the biological integrity of each group. But nature, like a farmer breeding cows, can improve the breed only by fostering the breeding of the better type and eliminating the poorer type. Nature accomplishes this task with the most powerful instincts we are given, love of our own, and hatred of those who intrude, or outsiders. Love and hatred in all caps. The most powerful instincts we are given, love and hate, us, them. So the Jew system of Christianity or liberalism would work against that by saying we're supposed to love your neighbor as yourself, and that love everyone universally. Promiscuous spiritual love, as I believe I'm the first to denounce, and how that can disorder a society by essentially telling you you have no enemies, everyone's just a friend you haven't met yet, everyone's just a convert to Jesusism you haven't met yet. And so you, whatever you may feel when you see a black or a brown or even a yellow, go against that. Override that feeling with this Jewish ideology we've given you called liberalism, called Christianity, called communism. They'll promote the same ends. Love is indeed incredibly powerful and good, says Rockwell, when it is natural, all caps. Love, the natural, healthy kind, is indeed what makes the world go round and is the most beautiful, holy miracle we ever see here on this earth. Now, an all caps sentence. But without a deadly hate of that which threatens what we love, love is an empty word, a catchword for hippies, queers, and cowards. Without hate, love is empty. I should like to write much more of this particular law of social living because, as we shall see, biological integrity, all caps, is the essence, the be-all, and the end-all of National Socialism when applied to Aryan society, and, indeed, of every healthy human society which has ever existed. But there simply is not space in this work for the book that could be written on this subject alone. I can only sum up by saying that the first law of all group living by social creatures is biological integrity, all caps, absolute, total, and uncompromising loyalty to one's own racial group based on a consuming love and absolute, uncompromising hatred of any outsiders who intrude and threaten to mix their genes with those of the females of one's own group. Remember, he had about 5 kids, I think. The everyday way this law is manifested is love of one's own kind and hatred of aggressive intruders, which is why most healthy whites have such instinctive abhorrence of niggers, Jews, and other aliens. The second most important law is the law of territory. Excuse me, all caps. For example, 10 or 20 males of the tiny tropical fish called swordtails will each stake out a section of a tank as soon as they are placed in it, and they will attack any intrusion by another male. If females are introduced into the tank, the males will fight over them, as expected, but the surprise to science was that sex is not the strongest motive in the life of these little fish, swordtails. If you start cooling the water in their tank, You can reach a point where the water is so cold the males no longer give much of a damn when you introduce the females. When the water gets so cold as to almost kill the little fish, they pay no attention at all to the females. But even when they are on the point of almost freezing to death, they will still come out ferociously to defend their territory, all caps, their private property. National socialism is based, among other things, on this concept of private property. The law of territory comes out as nationalism and private property in human society. Throughout the animal kingdom, the leader is never chosen by vote, but always by the natural selection established by nature as the only sure method of ensuring that the group is led by the best. Combat. This I have called the law of leadership, all caps. Once each member of an animal society learns his or her place in the natural biological order of toughness, wisdom, and cleverness, each member settles down into his own niche, and the group is relatively peaceful and orderly. Only when young males begin to mature and have to fight their way up or down the ladder is there serious battles. And then, as soon as each male learns who he can whip and who can whip him, he settles down and lives peacefully and contentedly in the place that he has found for himself. Thus is established two more of the fundamental principles or laws of all group living. Laws of group living: leadership by the best, and a natural hierarchy or scale of leadership of all the other members of the group. Status. Two fundamental principles of group living: leadership and status. Finally, a study of the animal world establishes that females stay out of the affairs of males and specialize in producing and rearing the young by organizing healthy families. To summarize, there are five basic laws of all group living, which I have called the laws of the tribe, all caps. Five basic laws of group living, the laws of the tribe. One, the law of biological integrity. Love inside, hate outside, dual code. Two, the law of territory, private property. Three, the law of leadership, by the best. Four, the law of status, or the natural place of every individual in a group. And five, motherhood for females. Biological integrity, territory, leadership, status, motherhood, five laws of all group living. Biological integrity, territory, leadership, status, motherhood. With these natural principles in operation, as they are throughout the whole world of social animals, there is a relative peace and order in the group. It is only when the group somehow is forced into unnatural conditions that the God-given instincts to obey these iron laws of nature fail. Only when the group is somehow forced into unnatural conditions do these laws fail. In evaluating all this in your own mind, think of the apparently crazy pattern of juvenile delinquency. We have the sons and daughters of some of the most advantaged and wealthy people suddenly seeming to go mad, beating up old folks, tearing things up senselessly, taking poisonous drugs, and becoming arrogant, antisocial criminals. At the same time, we find the children of some of the poorest groups in our society producing almost no delinquents at all. Until very recently, for instance, young Chinese were never delinquents, and they still have a far lower delinquency rate than other groups. This juvenile delinquency is a big, big problem. Kind of in the decades, that was the big problem of like the 50s or maybe the early 60s, compared to now when it would just be purely violence, stuff like that. The young of are tightly knit, even though very poor groups are often untouched by the modern madness of juvenile delinquency, so it's not a money thing. The young Chinese are maybe poor, but they're in the right context. And if you're in the right context, ultimately long enough, you're no longer poor. Why is this? Why should a wealthy young boy or girl become a thief, a vandal, and be violently antisocial in spite of all conceivable advantages, while the children of some of the poorest people in America are well-adjusted and constructive? The answer is that children who are brought up in a group which has managed to maintain some semblance of the laws of natural group living that he just described, the laws of the tribe, who feel that they are loyal members of a group, a tribe, that they belong to something or somebody worthwhile, and who therefore have a sense of the five basic laws of all group living, are not frustrated, not lost, and not empty. The Jews, with their spreading of liberalism and communism, and he ought to add Christianity, but he doesn't, have consciously and scientifically gone about the process of wiping from the souls of our people all memory of the sacred laws of the tribe, which alone can make a group of humanity healthy, happy, and peaceful. So again, they know what strengthens a group and what weakens it. They know these laws themselves. They want to uphold them, establish them, and revere them inside their group and destroy them for you and us and our kind, because that will rip us apart and let them feast on the tied-down body of our race. No human being can live in peace and productive happiness outside of some kind of tribe to which he is supremely loyal, and which in turn supports him spiritually. The Jews have spread the unspeakably destructive ideas of universalism, one-worldism, one mob of raceless, stateless, and atomized individuals as the supreme idea of mankind. Even the conservatives have been suckered into paying lip service to this same unnatural, fragmented, super-individualistic, Jewish disease of society. And it goes under 1,000 names. You want to make the essence out from the external, right? What's in the suit versus the suit. It could be called breaking barriers, globalism, Christianity, communism, internationalism, globalism, liberalism. These are all largely the same thing. Open society, anti-discrimination. Whatever prevents a man from exercising a rational will to create the context he wants to be part of, along with his fellows, his equals, his fellow whites, they will work to destroy. And Jews are promoting Jewish disease of society. We are told by the Jews that the law of biological integrity, love inside, hate outside, is racism, the ultimate evil of all time. We are told that if we do not love yellow men, black men, and especially Jews as much as our own people, then we are vicious, perverted, and doomed. We are racists. Millions of pitiful white suckers believe that Jewish lie. We are told that the law of territory or private property is an unnatural greed, and that decent men must wish to share everything and have no desire for their own private property. They call this Marxist socialism, communism, and various other names, indicating a concern for society and community. Social justice is another, equity. But all of them are striking at the heart of the most powerful and only motivation in living creatures to build, create, and produce. More millions believe these Jew liars as they strike at the laws of the tribe. We are told by the Jews that the law of leadership, rule of the best, is dictatorship, and that we must strive for democracy, rule by mobs. Millions of white Aryans have been suckered into believing this siren song of democracy until mobs of human garbage are now terrorizing our whole nation. We are told by Jews that the law of status, the establishment of the natural order of ability of each person in his right place, is, quote, class exploitation, and that the natural leaders of society, those who have been successful, must be smashed and murdered by those who have not. Whole nations full of good white Aryans have been suckered with this vile Jewish method of dividing and conquering our people through class warfare. Finally, we are told by these ever-loving Jews that the specialization of women in child-rearing is a beastly enslavement of our females, that women are intended to be judges, locomotive engineers, army officers, and business executives. The result, of course, is the growing destruction of that sacred and beautiful institution of all healthy civilizations, motherhood, and with it the home and the family. Our entire Western world has fallen for this democratic Jewish swindle, which has made women the most pitiful victims of the Jewish disease. Millions of modern women are hopelessly lost, frustrated, and utterly miserable, even while they are squawking about more, quote, rights through loudspeakers and marching around in hell-raising militant political organizations. And today we'd say with pink vagina hats on their heads. Meanwhile, millions of families are without warm, wonderful mothers, and homes are becoming more like luxurious jails than the miracles of love and warmth that were the homes of a century ago. Have you ever wondered why so many juvenile delinquents congregate in gangs? For years, like most people, I presume this was an unnatural perversity in, quote, bad boys, because I was brought up in a sort of bourgeois cocoon, knowing little of the brutal realities of life. But once one understands the laws of social living for all creatures, the human need to live by the laws of the tribe, gang becomes more understandable. It shows our kids, at least, still have healthy instincts, even though the outward manifestation of these instincts is vicious and antisocial as a result of the unnatural conditions imposed on the kids by their utterly unhealthy urban environment. Observe that gangs' very first characteristic is exclusiveness. They fanatically stick together. Attack one and they all attack you. Mess with one of the gang's females and you are dead. They are passionately loyal to each other, and they hate outsiders and attackers even more passionately. They have reasserted nature's holy laws of biological integrity, a group loyalty, although they know not why. Observe that the next thing a gang does is to stake out a turf, a territory. Woe unto him who violates that turf, infringes on the private property of the gang. Could anything more obviously exemplify the law of territory? The gang is never led by democratic elections, but by the toughest, the best, by the gang standards. Here is a classic example of the law of leadership. Observe how each of a gang's members is acutely aware of his own exact place in the gang, who is above him and who below. Let anybody try to move up on him and he gets smashed. Let him try to move up a notch and the guy above him will smash him. Here is the law of status, just as in nature. And finally, observe the females of a gang. Do they give any orders to the leader? No. Do they race around and demand rights? Hell no. They act in the manner of females and all the rest of the animal world and do not try to act like males. They glory in their role as females, as belonging to, and proudly helping a powerful male. And this is precisely the role of females in wholesome and happy societies, to belong to and help a powerful male. It's the role of the female. It is interesting to note that the Jewish Freudian psychiatrist fakers are being forced to return to the laws of the group, the laws of the tribe, to effect cures of drug addicts and alcoholics. They form a group and their powerful instincts of loyalty to that group can sometimes overcome lonely individual weaknesses. I guess he means Alcoholics Anonymous, formed on a Christian model. The blacks, too, in their blind and stupid struggling are doing the same thing, instinctively forming black loyalties, hollering black power, and calling each other soul brothers. In spite of the most extreme poverty on the Lower East Side of New York City in the early years of Jewish immigration after 1880, even these wretched swarms of Jewish refuse from Eastern Europe stuck together with such fanatical group loyalty, obeying all the laws of the tribe, that there was almost no delinquency and no crime against each other. Among them, there's a lot of crime outside them. In fact, the group loyalty of these Jews is perhaps the most fantastic in the history of the world. It has propelled them into near mastery of the entire world, not because they are braver, work harder, are more intelligent, or more worthy than the rest of us, but because they observe the basic laws of nature and maintain group loyalty. So Hitler and the Jews pay extremely close attention to nature, whereas doctrines, isms, ideologies Jews foist and promulgate and create and put out for white people are anti-nature. Instead of loving your own kind, you're supposed to love everybody. instead of your own group, you're supposed to love the entire world. While all the rest of us have fallen for their rotten one world, we are all brothers garbage, which disintegrates our society. The Jews maintain their society with a group loyalty such as history has never before been seen, and thus they go from one triumph to another. Not until Adolf Hitler, 50 years ago, began to see all this intuitively as a new worldview, Weltanschauung in German. Not until Hitler began to see all this as a new worldview, the Weltanschauung of National Socialism, did non-Jews gain their first insight into the emerging science of human group living. What we have done instinctively for centuries, and the Jews are still doing instinctively, Adolf Hitler began to see and understand intuitively. The essence of National Socialism is racism, which, in the simplest terms, is just the belief that humans differ in excellence of breed, exactly the same as all other living things, and that the white man is so far the finest breed to appear, while the blacks are the lowest. And as the reader will recall, this is the very first law of group living, quote, biological integrity, as I have designated it. Contrary to the abominable lies of the Jews and the conservatives, private property was powerfully protected by Adolf Hitler. Krupp and the other large or small property owners and businessmen never lost a cent under Hitler. Krupp, the arms dealer. Nor did the German princes. So Hitler was not a Marxist in the sense of stealing other people's property. He wasn't about that. Contrary to what the conservative liars will say. At one time, rabid leftists in his party wanted to dispossess the German princes, and Hitler had to put down a mutiny in his own ranks to protect their property rights, which he did. Hitler was a nationalist, a believer in territory, private property. Needless to point out, Hitler gave his people leadership, not sweet talk or demagoguery, and they loved him for it. They followed him lovingly and willingly, as do the members of all happy, successful, wholesome social groups. There was peace and order among Hitler's people because he taught that a man deserved and must get as much respect for being a good ditch digger, if that was the limit of his capacity, to serve his people, as the man who was able to invent a new and wonderful machine or be a political leader. Each person in Hitler's Germany was honored for his own place in society, provided he filled it to the best of his ability. They were not goaded eternally, as our people are by the Jews, to demand jobs only as presidents, chairman of the board, and executives when some people are not born with those particular talents. Accepting your station in life. To fail at what one could do, while raising hell and aiming for what one can't do, is to disrupt orderly and happy society, not to mention hopelessly frustrating the individual who refuses to recognize his natural place in the world. Thus, Hitler's state recognized the law of status. Each man was honored for what he did, loyally, and with his best effort, regardless of whether he was a farmer, a warrior, a laborer, a factory worker, or whatever, mind you, of ladder posters, head and hands working together, that sort of thing. Finally, Hitler saw to it that women were restored to their ancient birthright and honored as wives, mothers, and producers of happy, wholesome homes, as the authors of good people. Women as the authors of good people. The lies about Hitler times, are now so enormous and powerful that it is almost impossible to doubt them. But if you meet an honest and courageous German who lived through these great times, and he is willing to talk in spite of the terror which is abroad today for those who dare tell the truth, you will learn that the German people found out what good leadership and a natural healthy state is like under Hitler. To prevent that knowledge and that natural state of society from spreading, and thereby destroying the parasitic existence of Jewry, those Jewish devils provoked the rest of us to go and slaughter and smash this miracle of white Aryan renaissance. But natural law cannot be smashed any more than you can smash the fact that 2 and 2 equals 4. You may terrorize people out of saying it and get them all parroting 2 and 2 equals 17, But 2 and 2 is still 4, and there will always be someone with the guts and wisdom, sooner or later, to strike down the terrorists and liars to reassert the truth. And make sure you're one of those. Already, this is happening all over the world. The young gangs I have mentioned are only one sign of what is really going on. People will find their way back to the natural laws of the tribe. What Hitler gave the world, as National Socialism, is, in a sense, only a modern form of the ancient natural tribal law, the prescription for happy and healthy group living given by the Great Spirit to all living creatures, including man. National Socialism is nothing more or less than natural order, a name which would, in some ways, be more descriptive of the reality than National Socialism. Though National Socialism might better be called natural order. Hitler paid extremely close attention to nature. Hitler had to design the name of the movement to succeed in a specific political environment or situation, and was therefore forced to use names and terms which would accomplish his purposes, hence socialism. In Germany, there were millions and millions of Germans who thought of themselves as socialists, but were in the manipulating clutches of the Jews. Rather than fight any more battles than he had to, Hitler said, in effect, to these millions, "If you must be socialist, let us not be Jewish socialist, i.e. international socialists or Marxists. Let us be national socialists." Remember, communism is international. They're trying to spread this poison everywhere. "Let us be national socialist," meaning a national society. "Let us be socialist for Germany, not the Jews." And it worked. Millions and millions of good men and women who had been seduced into communism by the Jews were won back to their own people. And the natural order of healthy group living by Hitler's methods. Beyond the fundamental elements of natural order, which I have set forth above, National Socialism embodies something far higher and nobler than any mere set of rules or principles. National Socialism, as a philosophy, embodies the eternal urge found in all living things, indeed in all creation, toward a higher level of existence, toward perfection, toward God. And this would prefigure what William Pierce would turn into his own cosmotheism. There's a natural urge to move higher. This aristocratic idea of National Socialism, the idea of constant striving in all nature toward higher and higher, more and more complex, and more perfect existence, is the metaphysical, supernatural aspect of our ideal. In other words, concepts of social justice and natural order are the organs and nerves of National Socialism, but its personality, its religious aspect, the thing that lifts it above any strictly political philosophy, its worshipful attitude toward nature, and a religious love of the great gifts of an unknown creator. Christianity, for instance, is a far higher thing than its rituals, the words of its prayers, or any of its creeds. It is a spiritual striving toward the believer's ideals of spiritual perfection. National Socialism is the same sort of striving toward ever higher and higher levels here on this earth, while Christianity is striving toward a future and later life not of this earth. For the ordinary soldier, quote-unquote, in our, unquote, army, building and fighting for natural order, National Socialism, natural order, it is sufficient that they respect and obey the laws and doctrines established by the lofty ideals of our philosophy, with merely an instinctive love of those ideals, perhaps not with complete understanding of the highest forms of our philosophy. But just as the greatest Christian leaders have been those not preoccupied with details and rules, but rather those who were God-intoxicated with the highest ideals of the religion, the leaders among our National Socialist elite must share this fundamentally religious approach. For them, the true meaning of our racial doctrine must be part of their idealistic striving toward God. Now, in my opinion, he's making a bit of a mistake here, and you ought to point out that these are dueling. They are not, he's almost sounding like one can be fitted in the other when in fact they are on the same level and they are competitors. They are competitive belief systems, and Christianity was set up by Jews. And I won't go into it more at this point, but that's the truth. And this, I would fault him in that. And again, he's coming out of an age when everything was political, communist, the excessive focus on communism, not and less focus on race than he would probably have today. Through total identification of ourselves with our great race, we partake of its past and future glories. When we contribute in any way, especially by self-sacrifice toward helping our race along the path toward a higher existence, we reach toward God, the creator of the master race. In short, while the mechanics and rules of National Socialism, as codified and set forth here, are sufficient for most of us, for the few idealists ready and willing to sacrifice their very lives in the cause of their people, National Socialism must be a very real religious ideal, a striving toward God. National Socialism is the only movement that has gained sufficient self-knowledge and insight to be able to understand this movement away from liberal artificiality and short-sightedness, and toward the eternal wisdom of nature. Our all-out belief in race, our insistence on the natural laws in society, economics, and every other field of human activity, are, in every case, the conscious scientific application of nature's iron laws, instead of conceited and short-sighted perversions of these laws, as pushed by the arrogant peanut brain liberals and Marxists. Our liberal and Marxist opponents are just as blind to what they are doing, but in every case, it will be found that they are basically haters of the laws of nature, conceited, half-educated intellectuals who are the victims of truisms about, quote, a little knowledge being a dangerous thing. Because they have found they can teach a Congo Negro to recite poetry or even act like a lawyer or doctor, they get all puffed up with their ability to wrench nature around to suit themselves and imagine that they can make self-starting Western white men out of any Hottentot. The fact that nature has already made of the Negro what he is, and no human agency can make a silk purse out of a sow's ear, they simply refuse to acknowledge. Belief in human equality, human soul equality, human fungibility, it's just a matter of changing the conditions and the environment, and the Negro will be revealed, a white man who's been wood-stained, rather than a distinct, different creature. National Socialism is the distilled essence of the love and respect for nature and the loving, conscious, and scientific application of the eternal, just, and beautiful laws of nature to every moment of man's existence. At the same time, National Socialism recognizes man's need for a higher culture than that of the unthinking animals of the jungle, and there raises the application of natural law from the naked, tooth-and-fang competition of the animal world, for instance, to regulated and orderly competition under fair rules. Our opponents want to eliminate competition altogether, an utterly unnatural idea. National Socialism insists that man can refine and enrich the application of the natural laws of life for the benefits of man, but insists also that man cannot escape or defy natural law. Between the states of social health, National Socialism or natural order, and social disease, Jewish Marxism, lay the no man's lands of nothingness, the place where humans are neither dead nor really alive. Democracy, liberalism, and conservatism are pure, unadulterated states of nothingness. Democracy, liberalism, and conservatism, the main workaday politics, are pure, unadulterated states of nothingness. They have no basic fundamental outlook on life, no understanding, no vital force deep down inside them. They are fancy tricks with pretty words and phrases, meaning nothing at all. They lead only to chaos and prepare the way for the Jews and their damnable, unnatural communism. The only way we can ever put a stop to this Jewish con game and capture the minds and hearts of our people is to restore to our people natural order, the laws of the tribe, which alone will give us the strength and the will to reassert the natural biological superiority of our white race and thus save Western civilization. Destroy the cohesive forces of natural order in any group, and that group will become chaotic, hopeless, frustrated, lost, empty, vicious, in the old sense of vice-filled, and finally helpless before any other group that is united and obeys the law of the tribe. When we unite as a group, as a tribe, as a race, all of a sudden everything now going wrong starts to go right for us. That's why the blacks, in so many cases, terrify whole cities. They stick together. That's the ultimate reason the Jews dominate the world, is racial loyalty. The rest is just techniques. How? Mere material, mere technical matter. But the racial loyalty is the foundation of Jewish success and domination of other races. Racial loyalty is where it all begins. Even blacks, their low IQs, their stupidity, their short-sightedness, if they have racial loyalty, they can terrify whole cities, he says. They stick together. Hit one and a million blacks roar out at you. That's why police often no longer dare arrest them, even for the most outrageous offenses. And the Jews are even more powerful among us for the same reason. They stick together. Adding the laws of the tribe to the laws of race, which we examined earlier in chapter 9, we can synthesize a new law of modern society, the law of group dominance. The law of group dominance. In a state of nature, that animal or primitive human group that is biologically superior, the group composed of the best individuals carrying the best genes and chromosomes, will dominate all inferior groups because all groups in nature, superior or inferior, obey the laws of the tribe equally. Thus, the only factor operating competitively in the animal world is biological excellence of breeding. But scientific gadgetry, luxury, and Jewish liberalism, quote unquote, have so greatly destroyed the modern civilized white man's ability to feel and obey nature's laws of the tribe that he has lost his group cohesiveness. He has come unglued as a social animal. He has fragmented and atomized into millions of isolated individuals and hundreds of thousands of selfish pressure groups, classes, etc. This almost complete fragmentation of the great tribe of white men has reduced us to impotence as a group. The law of group dominance among men is the rule that any group which fanatically adheres to the natural laws of the tribe will be able to dominate any group which disobeys those laws, no matter how inferior may be the tribe which does obey the laws. This is why Negroes and Jews lorded all over the white man in America, built and owned by white men. This is why we suffer, quote, minority tyranny. Any organized minority of scum and human trash have the power, while the great white non-Jewish majority is a sprawling, helpless, paralyzed giant. The goal, then, of our National Socialist Revolution is the restoration of the laws of the tribe to our people, to enable their natural biological superiority of breeding once again to give the white man dominion of what he built and should dominate. This is exactly what Hitler and National Socialism did in Germany for millions and millions of fragmented, atomized people who were sunk in the depths of hopelessness and chaos. Hitler did not win such astounding success with his people because he was a tough guy, because he put on big, exciting rallies, because the Germans are natural beasts, nor any of the other reasons put forth by the lying Jews and their toady liberal and conservative allies. The reason Hitler was able to accomplish a social miracle in Germany was because Hitler intuitively understood all that I have written and restored his people to natural social order. Hitler understood all this about the tribe intuitively and restored his people to natural social order. He de-inverted it, could say. Hitler taught his people to quit hating each other as isolated, lonely, and frightened individuals and gave them back that holy sense of nationhood, of tribe, yes, of real brotherhood, not the artificial kind peddled by the Jews. There is nothing wrong and everything right about brotherhood with your own people. It is when the Jews slyly and falsely try to extend brotherhood to pull the hood over the brother and try to make us brothers with Zulus, Pygmies, Chinese, Bushmen, and Jews that brotherhood becomes a byword for racial catastrophe, as it has. Hitler gave his people the same sacrificial spirit of warm love for one's family and one's people, which is a big family, which unites and blesses every natural social group of creatures in creation. As I have pointed out many times, no man can live happily, successfully, and productively as a lonely, bitter individual at war with all his fellows. Every one of us has a deep need for the warmth and love of his group, of those in his biological family of people. Modern man has lost that feeling of group warmth, loyalty, and love, and the result is the chaos and spiritual emptiness we see all around us in this disintegrating Western society. The horrors depicted in the first chapter of this book are the direct result of America's almost total disobedience of the laws of the tribe. These horrors would continue, even if all the Jews and Negroes were to disappear overnight, unless we restore to our people, as Hitler did, the natural order, laws of the tribe. Our revolution, therefore, is not material and physical, but a radical spiritual change in the feelings of our people. The elimination of selfish atomism and greedy, narrow individualism, whether it be called liberalism, conservatism, or democracy, and the restoration in the hearts of Western white men of the deeply satisfying feelings of love for our own kind. This love of one's group manifests itself in the willingness to sacrifice and give for one's family and the larger family of one's race. And that ends chapter 15. And now his last chapter, chapter 16, White Power, which is about 3 pages, which is why I'm including it with 50. George Lincoln Rockwell, White Power, chapter 16, last chapter, titled White Power. Make no mistake about it, I am advocating total and complete white power in this world! White men can no longer shilly-shally around with compromises and half-hearted measures to protect their own lives and interests. What we face is not a social, philosophical, economic, religious, or territorial battle, but a struggle between quality, the elite but minority white race, against quantity, the vast swarms of subhuman scum who have been gathered up under the banners of Jewish Marxism to be used as a giant battering ram against the white race. Our beleaguered race will organize itself and fight for its own survival, or the scum of the earth will inundate it. If we continue to hesitate, to rationalize, and to temporize with half-hearted measures, we will be obliterated from the face of the planet. This is truly scum power with a vengeance, so it's either white power or scum power. Like some horrible multiplication of roaches who, if there be only enough of them, can literally smother the greatest thinker or fighter in history, the scum of the world are gathering for the attack. And there are 7 of them for every one of us. The only answer to scum power must be and is white power. And that's good rhetoric, scum power versus white power. The power of the elite of the world, the white human beings who have already proved their natural God-given superiority over this gathering swarm of scum, must drive it back, reestablish order and culture in the world, and maintain that order, the only way order has ever been maintained, by force. Today there is no segment of the white race left on earth with a possibility of turning back the scum except the white men of the United States of America. America is the only nation, as a matter of cold fact, with the physical power to master the scum. The center of Jewish power and money is here in New York City, USA, not Moscow, and not even Jerusalem. And the American working man and farmer still has in him the good and wholesome racial instincts of our ancestors, who, time after time, drove back the mongrel hordes by sheer force of guts and will. I am well aware of the upswelling of revulsion which comes over many Europeans at the thought of the sort of America they have seen and experienced ever being able to reestablish Western culture. And they can hardly be blamed. Quote, American representatives in Europe today are, for the most part, Jews. The media and the diplomats. The American foreign policy they have seen, which destroyed their countries, slaughtered their people, and turned half of Europe over to communism, and which today continues to give aid and comfort to white men's enemies while destroying their friends, was and is directed, inspired, and instigated by Jews. In short, Europeans have seen America only through Jewish eyes. They have seen Americans who are not Americans at all, but Jews. But, my fellow white men of Europe, believe me when I tell you that America is brimming over with good and brave men, men who share your blood and will bring honor to our race when they finally see the urgent necessity of rolling up their sleeves for an all-out fight. But aside from that point, the eternal jealousies, rivalries, and blood feuds between segments of the white race must be stopped as a matter of strategic necessity, not to be continued for the benefit of united world Jewry. White men of Europe, put aside, if you can, the memory of two world wars in which we joined hands with our mortal enemies to slaughter your finest young men. We too shed our blood in those unholy wars. Forgive us for being so blind, for turning the deadly power of our might against you instead of against the Jewish communism that is now devouring us all. Forgive us for the misery and degradation we forced upon you, and join us in the last-ditch fight for our race and respective nations. This time, it will be different. This time, we shall stand together as brothers against a common foe. This time, the traitors will find no white man anywhere who will listen to their lies and fight their battles for them. This time, we shall have no mercy for those who have caused untold suffering among our people. We shall give no quarter to those who have lived among us for no purpose other than to destroy us. This time, together, we shall drive the bastards to the wall. How is this to be done? Believe it or not, it is not terribly difficult. The only obstacle in our path at the moment is the unbelievable ability of our people to rationalize and temporize in the face of deadly danger. The horse is infinitely more powerful than a man and could stomp him to death if he ever realized it, but he doesn't realize it, and so he goes on in harness, pulling and hauling and tied up. The vast majority of Americans are fed up to the teeth with arrogant Jews stealing their wealth and rioting blacks tearing up their streets. But, like the horse, they know not their own strength. Here in America, white men outnumber alien scum by enormous margins. If ever they realize the strength their numbers represent, nothing on earth can stop them from stomping to death the filthy subversives and traitors who have been beating them, lying to them, stealing from them, and finally turning a mob of black African savages loose on them. Once a horse finds he can stomp a man and get away with it, he is an outlaw. Nothing more can be done to make a drudge of him. The only reason the white men of America cannot now feel their strength, even though they are the overwhelming majority with unheard-of strength, is that the Jews, through their control of our entire system of communications, have been able to keep them apart. Most white men in their hearts agree with the things I've said in this book, but they think they are alone. The Jews have recognized the inborn sense of fair play in the white man. They have recognized the white man's deep-rooted desire for order and his innate repugnance for that which upsets his order. And they have taken advantage of those good and wholesome qualities. They have used the best in us to destroy us. TV, radio, movies, books, magazines, newspapers, schools, and even our own government officials tell us constantly and repeatedly that it isn't nice to believe an African ape is not our equal, albeit the facts conclusively prove our superiority in all matters pertaining to a civilized society. It isn't nice, we're taught to believe, to want our bloodlines kept pure, to want our grandchildren white. It isn't nice to point to the filth, immorality, crime, and disease that move into a neighborhood on the heels of black neighbors. It isn't nice to want our children educated on their own level instead of being held down to that of the stupid black. It isn't nice, we are told, because it isn't fair. But let's turn it around. Is it nice to have our women live in constant fear of being raped or murdered by a black ape on the rampage? Is it nice to have our children adopting the language, attitudes, and morals of subhuman scum? Is it nice to have our men competing with illiterates for their livelihood and having the illiterates come out on top? Is it nice to tolerate taxes and inflationary prices to support the multiplication of black scum when it drives our mothers from the home and family into the factories? Is it nice to leave our children the inheritance of a world government by alien scum? Hell no, it isn't nice, and it isn't fair. You're a slave in your own country, white man. Each year you get to keep less and less of the fruits of your labor. Each year it gets more difficult to carry the burden the aliens have placed upon you. Each year the cheap labor of aliens makes your future less secure. Each year you retreat a few steps more into the world of slavery. Where will it all end? I'll tell you. It will end with a complete and total annihilation of Whitey, Whitey in quotes. Stop rationalizing a situation you know to be deadly serious. Stop temporizing with halfway measures in a situation that screams for decisive action. Stop using business, social etiquette, family, and security as an excuse for downright cowardly behavior. If you hesitate very much longer, the fight will be over and the white man will have lost. Stand up and fight. And with those words, he closes chapter 16 and the entire book, White Power, by the late George Lincoln Rockwell. Thanks for being with me today. And as always, you can find permanently archived any material we put out as part of the Learning College, which you're free to disseminate however you find best, permanently archived at vnnforum.com. Thanks for being with me, and I'll be with you with another excellent work real soon.